Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, we present a promising new therapy for dermatomyositis, evolving approaches to stroke care, the prevention of COVID-19 after household exposure, and new treatments for kidney disease. We review inflammatory myopathies and follow a complex case of multi-system illness. Perspectives discuss AI and uncertainty in clinical care, health equity, the forces shaping affordability in healthcare, and on unpacking the ordinary. A phase 3 trial of brepocitinib in dermatomyositis by Ruth Ann Vleugels from Harvard Medical School, Boston, and co-authors. Dermatomyositis is a systemic autoimmune disease characterized by inflammation and progressive damage to the muscles, skin, lungs, joints, heart, and gastrointestinal tract. This condition often follows a chronic, unpredictable, and protracted disease course and can be associated with substantial morbidity, impaired quality of life, and disability in affected patients. Current therapies are associated with incomplete efficacy, treatment-related toxic effects, and challenges with administration. Brepocitinib is a first-in-class oral selective TYK2 JAK1 inhibitor that blocks cytokine signaling, which has been implicated in dermatomyositis. In this phase 3 trial, 241 patients with dermatomyositis that was resistant to previous therapy were randomly assigned to receive once-daily oral brepocitinib at a dose of 30 milligrams or 15 milligrams or placebo for 52 weeks. Standard therapies were continued and glucocorticoids were tapered. Among these adults, the use of brepocitinib at a dose of 30 milligrams, but not at a dose of 15 milligrams, resulted in significant benefits with respect to a composite myositis index, skin disease severity, glucocorticoid tapering, and functional disability. Ingrid Lundberg from the Karolinska Institute at Stockholm writes in an editorial that the positive results of the trial are notable. In the patients who received the 30 milligram daily dose of brepocitinib, improvement was observed as early as 4 weeks. Such improvement included significantly better placebo-adjusted scores concerning skin health, including inflammatory skin lesions. Improvement in the brepocitinib 30 milligram group was seen even after tapering of the glucocorticoid dose to less than 2.5 milligrams per day or to complete cessation of glucocorticoids, which is clinically significant, because the side effects of long-term use of high doses of glucocorticoids contribute to complications in patients with myositis. However, although the change in muscle strength was measured as an exploratory outcome, the improvement in muscle strength did not seem clinically significant as compared with the placebo group. Going forward, more studies are needed to explore whether brepocitinib is also effective with respect to muscle strength and to severe forms of dermatomyositis, including among myositis patients with rapidly progressive interstitial lung disease, a subgroup with a pressing need for new therapies. Endovascular treatment of medium vessel occlusion strokes by Wei Hu from the First Affiliated Hospital of the University of Science and Technology of China, Hefei, and co-authors. Endovascular thrombectomy for patients with acute ischemic stroke due to medium vessel occlusion has had varying results across trials. These investigators evaluated whether thrombectomy improves functional outcomes in patients with medium vessel occlusion and moderate to severe deficits. 563 adults who presented within 24 hours after the onset of a moderate to severe stroke due to occlusion of a medium vessel were randomly assigned to thrombectomy plus medical management or medical management alone. The median age of the patients was 71 years. The median National Institutes of Health stroke scale score, which ranges from 3 to 36, was 10, and 42.8% of the patients were women. Among these patients, thrombectomy led to a greater likelihood of functional independence than medical management alone, but also to a higher risk of symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage. In an editorial, Johanna Ospel and Michael Hill from the University of Calgary and Foothills Medical Center, Alberta, Canada, write that some patients with stroke due to medium vessel occlusion, specifically those with a younger age, higher stroke severity, and early presentation who are not sequentially or concurrently treated with thrombolysis, will be most likely to benefit from endovascular thrombectomy. This result is concordant with the previous ESCAPE MEVO and DISTAL trials, in which post hoc analyses suggested that favorable baseline imaging, good collaterals, PL vessel filling, or a favorable mismatch profile on CT perfusion imaging, and faster treatment are likely to be important in terms of outcomes. The imaging criteria used in the current trial were based on physician judgment and will be essential to translate into practice. Well-evolved infarcts may be readily recognized in everyday clinical practice, but are hard to define precisely. Patients with well-evolved infarcts simply do not benefit, and a small proportion may be harmed with reperfusion therapies. Intra-arterial thrombolysis and new, trackable, low-profile endovascular thrombectomy devices could improve the technical success of endovascular thrombectomy. New studies are planned or underway to further refine the procedure and the target population. And citralvir for COVID-19 post-exposure prophylaxis in household contacts by Frederick Hayden from the University of Virginia School of Medicine, Charlottesville, and co-authors. And citralvir, an oral inhibitor of SARS-CoV-2 3C-like protease, is approved in Japan for the treatment of mild to moderate COVID-19. Previously, no antiviral agents were approved for post-exposure prophylaxis in household contacts of patients with COVID-19. In this trial conducted in the United States, Argentina, Japan, South Africa, and Vietnam, more than 2,000 persons who were SARS-CoV-2 negative on local diagnostic testing, but were household contacts of a patient with COVID-19, the index patient, were randomly assigned to receive either ensitrelvir or placebo within 72 hours after symptom onset in the index patient. The incidence of COVID-19 was lower in the ensitrelvir group than in the placebo group, 2.9% versus 9%. Ensitrelvir was effective in preventing COVID-19 in household contacts of an index patient with COVID-19. Telitacicept for IgA nephropathy, interim analysis of a phase 3 trial by Jichang Liu from the Peking University First Hospital, Beijing, and co-authors. The pathogenesis of IgA nephropathy is mediated by B-cell activating factor, BAF, and a proliferation-inducing ligand, APRIL. Telitacicept is a fusion protein that targets and neutralizes both BAF and APRIL, and as such might be effective in IgA nephropathy. These investigators report a pre-specified interim analysis of a phase 3 trial, which enrolled adults with biopsy-proven IgA nephropathy and persistent proteinuria, despite appropriate supportive care. 318 patients were randomly assigned to receive subcutaneous once-weekly telitacicept or matching placebo. At 39 weeks, treatment with telitacicept led to a greater reduction in the 24-hour urinary protein-to-creatinine ratio than placebo. Adverse events were more common with telitacicept than with placebo in 89.3% versus 78.6% of patients, although serious adverse events were less common in 2.5% versus 8.2%. Inflammatory myopathies, a review article by Yves Allenbach and Olivier Benveniste from the Groupe Hospitalier Pitié-Salpêtrière, Paris. Inflammatory myopathies are a heterogeneous group of autoimmune diseases characterized by immune-mediated damage to skeletal muscle. They are classified into 5 major subtypes: inclusion body myositis, immune-mediated necrotizing myopathies, antisynthetase syndrome, overlapping myositis, and dermatomyositis. each with distinct clinical features and outcomes. Muscle involvement is the hallmark of idiopathic inflammatory myopathies. Mode of onset, topography of weakness, muscle enzyme levels, and myopathological features distinguish the different subgroups. Inclusion body myositis and immune-mediated necrotizing myopathies primarily affect muscle, with prognosis largely determined by functional impairment, whereas antisynthetase syndrome, overlapping myositis, and dermatomyositis are systemic diseases that can involve the skin, joints, and lungs, and may be life-threatening. The majority of inflammatory myopathies are associated with myositis-specific autoantibodies, which inform diagnosis, subtype classification, and prognosis. Advances in understanding the distinct pathomechanisms underlying each subgroup now enable increasingly targeted therapeutic approaches. A 50-year-old woman with vaginal bleeding and anemia. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Joshua Zipperstein and colleagues. A 50-year-old woman presented with acute, heavy vaginal bleeding and severe anemia on a background of months of progressive systemic symptoms, including Raynaud's phenomenon. 6 months earlier, she had developed worsening proximal muscle weakness, leg edema, fatigue, and intermittent fevers, eventually limiting mobility. She also noted diffuse alopecia and dyspnea on exertion. She had a 2-year history of irregular vaginal bleeding attributed to uterine fibroids. On evaluation, she had profound anemia, leukopenia, and worsening thrombocytopenia, along with elevated inflammatory markers. Physical examination revealed proximal muscle weakness, scalp changes, lymphadenopathy, and splenomegaly. Imaging confirmed multi-station lymphadenopathy and splenomegaly, and urinalysis showed hematuria and proteinuria. The differential diagnosis included 3 major categories: malignancy, such as lymphoma, given cytopenias and lymphadenopathy, infection, and autoimmune disease. The chronic, multi-system course with Raynaud's phenomenon, cytopenias, alopecia, myopathy, and renal involvement favored an autoimmune process, particularly systemic lupus erythematosus, although atypical features raised concerns for overlapping or alternative diagnoses. This presentation ultimately led to a diagnosis of an overlap syndrome of systemic lupus erythematosus and idiopathic inflammatory myopathy. Can AI say, "I don't know"? A perspective by Andrea Sikora from the University of Colorado School of Medicine, Aurora, and co-authors. A first-year resident is asked, "What explains this patient's rising creatinine?" She pauses. "I don't know." The team reviews the patient's medications and risk factors and chooses a cautious plan involving checking drug levels and requesting a nephrology consult. A clinical AI system is presented with the same case. It retrieves relevant articles, but despite conflicting evidence, it produces a confident answer without flagging the uncertainty involved in applying the selected studies to the patient in question. There are few clinical scenarios more problematic than a practitioner being confidently wrong. Clinicians are rightly expected to disclose their gaps in knowledge or their inability to forecast an outcome. Yet emerging AI tools often cannot, or will not, do the same. In an analysis of large language models, LLMs, that were presented with 300 physician-designed vignettes, each including one fabricated detail, the LLMs accepted and amplified the falsehood 50 to 82% of the time. In short, most models didn't say, "I don't know." Current methods for training AI systems rarely reward abstaining from answering a question, and regulations typically don't require this capability. Yet, if AI is going to support clinical reasoning, systems will need to be able to indicate uncertainty. This behavior could be taught and assessed for humans and machines alike. These authors believe clinical AI systems should be trained to express calibrated uncertainty in ways that can extend and indicate the need for epistemic humility in human users, and their performance in these areas should be assessed. Overcoming the Digital Divide in Healthcare AI, a perspective by David Blumenthal from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Boston, and co-authors. Complex, costly new healthcare technologies have historically tended to be less available to financially, racially, and geographically marginalized groups than to the rest of the population. In the realm of health information technology, this disparity has been labeled the digital divide. Available evidence suggests that a further digital divide may develop in the use of AI, but these authors believe that certain policy approaches could help reduce that gap. The health AI digital divide may take several forms. It may consist of delayed or reduced adoption of AI by healthcare facilities and professionals that serve marginalized groups. It may also appear in the form of biases within these technologies that adversely affect vulnerable populations. The digital divide may also reflect and reinforce lower levels of digital healthcare literacy among people in those groups than in the broader population. Policy options are available to ameliorate these different types of digital disadvantages. In this article, the authors focus on sources and potential remedies of AI digital divides arising from the delayed or reduced adoption of AI by healthcare organizations serving marginalized populations. A sleeping giant of healthcare affordability. Self-insured employers. A perspective by Zuri Song from Harvard Medical School and Suhas Gandhi from the Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston. More than half of Americans have employer-sponsored health insurance, the coverage sector where healthcare prices have risen the fastest. More than 60% of this population is covered by self-insured or self-funded plans. The employers or unions themselves, not insurance companies, pay the medical bills of their workers and workers' dependents. Increasingly, healthcare expenses among these workers and families are driving the nation's reckoning over the cost of living and the policy shift toward affordability. Medical and pharmaceutical spending has increasingly crowded out core business activities and suppressed wage growth, particularly for low-income workers and people from underserved racial and ethnic groups. For example, Starbucks pays more for health care than it does for coffee beans. With these costs driven by consolidation of healthcare providers, which leads to higher negotiated prices, increasing utilization, including service and billing intensity, and expensive drugs, employers have struggled to respond. Employers have long shifted these costs onto workers in the form of higher premiums, higher cost sharing, or slower wage growth. As a result, increases in worker contributions to employer-sponsored insurance have outpaced even the growth in total costs of coverage. With multiple barriers limiting their ability to respond, employers in general have not adequately addressed healthcare affordability. But these barriers are not insurmountable. If employers leveraged their collective power to actively manage their health benefits, their efforts could boost their businesses, raise their workers' take-home pay, and improve the appropriateness of care for their plan's enrollees. Unpacking the Ordinary, a perspective by Christy Ramprasad from the Toronto General Hospital, Canada. It was a Friday night on call. A new patient had been admitted for a possible kidney transplant. The patient sat at the edge of the bed, shoulders rigid, knees keeping time with a private metronome. They walked through the risks and logistics, the choreography that precedes a transplant. When the forms were signed and the consent witnessed, the patient exhaled and said almost to herself, "I don't know what to do with myself till then." That was when Dr. Ramprasad noticed the suitcase, a small black roller bag parked by the couch, its handle locked upright as if it were already halfway out the door. "Anything fun in there?" Dr. Ramprasad asked. "Not really," the patient said. "Inside were rows of peritoneal dialysis supplies, dialysate bags stacked like fragile bricks, tubing coiled into factory-tight spirals, cartridges locked neatly in place." Not a weekend bag at all. 10 kilograms of burden disguised as a carry-on. She said, next trip, I'm packing pajamas, maybe books. After the transplant, when the anesthesia was receding, the patient blinked awake, half propped on pillows, IV lines angling from her arms. Congratulations on your new kidney, Dr. Rampersad said, unable to keep the smile from her voice. The logistics they discussed then were no longer hypothetical. They were the scaffolding for a new routine. When Dr. Rampersad turned to leave, she saw the suitcase tucked inside the closet by the door, suddenly inconspicuous. Its contents were already obsolete. Nephrology's ordinary is not glamorous. It looks like lab values and ins and outs flow sheets. It can be tedious, and it can be heavy. But what that small black carry-on taught Dr. Rampersad, sometimes the most ordinary thing in the room is also the most miraculous. In our images in clinical medicine, a 50-year-old man presented to the emergency department with a one-month history of headache and worsening weakness of the left arm and leg. Brain MRI showed an enhancing lesion with extensive surrounding edema. Further testing led to a diagnosis of cerebral syphilitic gamma, a rare manifestation of long-standing syphilis. In another image, a 55-year-old man presented with cough, chest pain, and worsening dyspnea after being trapped in a burning house for 10 minutes. On physical examination, the patient was covered in soot but had no burn injuries. Bronchoscopy revealed carbonaceous deposits that extended along the airway, shown in a video at nejm.org. In a third image, a 65-year-old woman with cardiovascular risk factors presented with a 14-hour history of painless, worsening, blurry vision in the right eye, with a visual acuity of 20 over 400. Fundoscopy showed diffuse retinal hemorrhages and marked venous dilatation in all four quadrants, findings known as a blood and thunder appearance. A diagnosis of central retinal vein occlusion was made. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.